Hello, today I have a midweek treat for you. Your regular second episode of Where Are You Going will still arrive in your feed as normal on Friday, so don't panic. But as an extra special one-off, I'm going to share an episode of a podcast which the whole Where Are You Going team enjoy today. It's called Happy Place and is hosted by Fern Cotton. She's on a mission to find out where real contentment can come from, so in each episode she talks to one well-known person about where they found happiness. I've chosen to share this particular episode with you because it's with the author Raina Wynne, and I've loved every single one of her books, the first of which was about the Southwest Coast Path, which is definitely my happy place, and is also featured on Where Are You Going? So I really hope you enjoy it. You can follow Happy Place on Instagram at Happy Place Official. You can also download the Happy Place app. It's chock full of fun things like bonus episodes, meditations, and even sound baths to enjoy in your headphones. You just never know what you might discover. Thanks.
Hello and welcome to Happy Place, the show that questions what we're generally told about what happiness is. I'm Fern Cotton and today I'm meeting Raina Wynne.
I've felt some of my greatest happiness in the most extremely difficult for me situations, walking on the coast path with no money, no food, nowhere to live. Some of the happiest moments of my life because there was nothing else. All that mattered was the next step and the next bag of noodles.
Raina is a long-distance walker, a wild camper, and has written award-winning books about those experiences. First The Salt Path, then The Wild Silence, and now Landlines. And I don't even know how to begin to tell you how much I love these books. I'm a mega fan. Within days of learning that her husband Moth was terminally ill, the couple had their home taken away from them and lost their livelihood as a result too. Appreciating that there were huge parts of this horrendous situation they couldn't control, they turned the entirety of their anger into positivity by grabbing hold of the parts of life they did have control over. They picked a path and they started walking. That impulsive decision to walk the 630 miles of the Southwest Coast Path led not only to a completely new outlook on life, but an improvement in Moth's health. Obviously, Raina's put what she's learned into the books, but she's also been putting on shows that just sound like the most beautiful evenings because she's basically combined tales of her walks with gorgeous folk music, which is brilliant because folk music obviously has such a strong sense of place. So Raina's book and stories are about the wild and beautiful nature and people she and Moth met on their walks. But really, I think they're about the human spirit, what we're capable of enduring, and how we're able to find light in incredibly dark places. Okay, here it is. Here's the show. Raina, thank you so much for being on Happy Place.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, I love your books so much. And they've just been a tonic to me just to get into bed with one of your books and to escape into these incredible journeys and experiences you've had has just been a joy. So thank you for writing them.
Oh, no, I mean, it's great to have put those stories out there and for people to connect with them. So.
I mean, they're massively connected. Like your first book, The Salt Path, which I literally couldn't put down, has been unbelievably popular for so many reasons. For anyone that hasn't read this book, it might be a good idea that we just sort of cover that quite large story just so people have an understanding of what the subsequent books are based on. And I think also how you've helped so many people, because I think you've helped a lot of people in terms of having hope, but also making a big pivot in life and doing something very spontaneous. So if you could take us back to, I guess, the summer of 2013, or you might want to go back even further, I don't know.
2013, probably just go back a little bit further. I'd been living in this place in Wales that I'd bought with my husband, Moth. It was our dream home, a place we'd thought about for probably a decade before we actually bought it. It was a ruined house in the hills, holes in the walls, and the roof was falling in, but it was exactly what we were looking for. And we'd spent 20 years of our lives restoring a place, you know, building it and converting the outbuildings into holiday homes so people could come and stay and share a place with us. And it became not just our home, our family home, but our business, where it was the main source of income, but where all of our life was tied up. So the whole framework of our life was contained really within that property. But then sadly, in the background of those 20 years, we'd had this financial dispute with a lifetime friend that ended in a court case that saw us being served with an eviction notice from that place that we put our heart and soul into, that had been so central to our lives. And they gave us a week to pack 20 years of life into boxes and leave, which was hard enough in itself and seemed like the worst thing that was ever going to happen. But then in that week, my husband Moth had a hospital appointment that we thought was going to be routine, turned out to be anything but, and he was diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease that had no treatment and no cure. And the best advice they could give us was don't get too tired and be careful on the stairs. So we were about to leave. It was the last moments. The bailiffs were knocking on the door, and we were hiding under the stairs, actually, because we thought a miracle would happen, but because we just weren't ready to take that last step out of the house.
How could you be?
How could you be? But that moment, that was the moment when I spotted a book in a packing case. And it was a book about a young man who'd walked the southwest coast path with his dog. And just then, in that awful moment, it seemed like the most obvious thing to do. Fill a rucksack, go for a walk. Why wouldn't you?
I was so taken aback by that, reading The Salt Path, that you had the strength, I guess, and the energy with all of that going on, which is emotionally depleting, physically horrific to go through, because you're having to just move your whole life out of, as you say, your home, your heart, your soul, like everything that you'd built. And rather than go, right, how do we start again? What is possible? You kind of pushed it to one side for a bit to have this time and space to go on this epic walk, and you didn't have an end date, or you had like a loose idea of where you'd like the walk to finish. But really it was like, let's just get a backpack and walk. And I find that just remarkable that you had that inner strength, and that, I guess, there must have been something deep within you that was intuitively pulling you towards that walk.
I think at the moment, that moment when we said, yes, let's walk, I think it was just the idea of following a line on a map. Because at that point, it was, as I said, all of our lives were wrapped up in that property. So it was like the whole framework that we'd built, everything that we'd built over the previous 20 years, gone. And it just left a void. So the idea of following that map almost gave us a sense of purpose, a sense of reason to the days, a reason to go on. Because at that point, I think I felt like there was no reason.
Yeah.
Later, looking back, you know, analysing it a bit more in the second book, maybe I can see where those choices came from. But at that moment, it was just about that map.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I thought that I'd done some big walks, but they pale into complete insignificance in comparison to your walks. I did a couple of treks in my 20s. I did the Inca Trail, which I absolutely loved. I did Kilimanjaro, which I absolutely loved. But they were very organised, and you have, you know, people there, guides showing you where to go, and you have help putting your tent up at the end of the day. There's a food tent, but you guys were quite literally wild camping. You had a tiny tent that you would just have to pop up wherever you could see fitting, which was much more challenging than you'd actually assumed, right?
Yeah, it was really quite difficult. We couldn't use campsites because we really just didn't have enough money to afford to do that. So wild camping was the only option, really. So the the tent just had to go wherever we could find a flat patch, away from people, away from where we would cause any problem or difficulty for anybody else. And that's not easy to find.
No.
Yeah, but we did end up spending night after night on headlands, in woodlands, on beaches. And that became the most remarkable thing about that walk, was that sort of sense of being part of the wild landscape around us, really.
Yeah, and obviously that took some time, because the first sort of initiation into that walk was tricky, and you had very small amounts of rations of food, and at times you didn't know where your next meal was going to come from. But like you say, there was so many incredible, and I'm sure at the time felt quite sort of surprising, positives that came out of this really treacherous time for you. One of them being that Moth's health seemed to really improve on this first walk on the Salt Path, where you started in, was it North Devon, and then you moved right down to South Devon, South Cornwall.
Yeah, follows the whole coastline from Somerset, North Devon, Cornwall, South Devon into Dorset. So it's the whole of the southwest.
Yeah,
really.
Huge walk. And as you say at the start of us talking, you were given this loose advice, you know, don't let him get too tired, don't tackle stairs, chill as much as you can. And you did the absolute opposite. Like, you could not walk anymore if you possibly tried, day in, day out, sleeping on the floor, in tents. But you both started to notice these improvements. So first of all, can you just tell us the nature of CBD? What does that mean for a human body? What are the symptoms? And how did you see those symptoms dissipate over time?
Yeah, well, corticobasal degeneration, it's a neurodegenerative disease. It's known as a tauopathy because it sort of originates from the tau protein in the brain not functioning as it normally would, and sort of causing almost a bit like plaque on your teeth, but in the cells in your brain. And it affects so much of the body's movement initially. Initially, it sort of manifests as coordination issues, and people have problems with walking, with fine motor issues. But then it develops into something far more aggressive that eventually can affect the way you think, the way you process, and eventually leads to swallowing difficulties, which inevitably don't end well. So that was the prognosis we were given. That was the future we were given.
And quite a short lifespan in terms of being diagnosed and how much longer Moth had at this point.
Yes, because he'd had symptoms for quite a long time by that point. So on the average of lifespan of people with CBD, he was well into those years.
I mean, that is unbelievably just catastrophic to hear that diagnosis. You've been with Moth since you were a teenager. He's the love of your life. And all of a sudden, not only are you losing your home, but you're being given that news in the same week. I still kind of can't get over that you just didn't go, fuck this, I give up, I can't take anymore.
Yes, but you've said it there, Fern. He was everything. We'd met when I was 18 in a college canteen. I'd looked up and seen this young man across the other side of the canteen dipping a Mars bar in a cup of tea. And just in that moment, I just knew without question that he was the one. And then we had spent the rest of the whole of my adult life with him. And just the idea of letting go of that seemed utterly impossible. So to not do something positive, as the walk turned out to be, would have needed us to do something that accepted all that negativity and accepted that we were in a really bad place, and also that this diagnosis was real. Mm-hmm. And that Moth's time with me was going to be short. I couldn't accept that. So the only other thing to do was something positive.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, but you didn't know at that point that it was going to be positive.
Oh, goodness, no. But it felt positive because it wasn't submitting to all the anxiety and fear and anger that we were feeling at that moment.
So what did you do? Because, you know, you had a lifelong friend, as you've said, who essentially saw you lose your home, knowingly saw you lose your whole life that you'd built together. What do you do with all that anger? I mean, I can't imagine. I can sort of switch to anger quite quickly, and I don't like that about my personality, but I can feel it if there feels like there's injustice or something just has played out unfairly. I often don't know what to do with that. And you had this on insurmountable levels. You must have felt like the world was against you at this point. What did you do with all of that?
We really did, because it was such betrayal of trust with our friend, but also just anger because the legal system hadn't seen the truth of it. So there was so much anger, so much bitterness. And I think had we not taken that walk, that would have come to define us.
Yeah.
It would have overwhelmed us, and that is what we would have become. But there was something on those headlands, something about just being there in the environment, taking the next step, just climbing the next headland, that somehow allowed that to wear away. I don't know, in the book, I describe it like having jagged stones in my pocket. But after 200 miles of headlands, it's almost like they've worn down to smooth beach pebbles. Mm. And that's how it felt, as if somehow just being there in on that incredible strip of wilderness there between the ordinary world and the endless horizon of the sea. There was just something like being in another world almost.
Did you feel, was there an element of feeling like you were taking control back? Because you'd been so handed this deck of cards, you're losing your home, all of a sudden the love of your life has this illness. Two situations where you feel very out of control. Did this sort of choice of we're going to do this, we've made our own mind up and we're going to do this walk and it's not the conventional thing to do, did that somehow feel safer or grounding because you had some control over it?
Yes, absolutely. And it was a complete loss of control, because when you lose your house and you have no income, then you have no control. And everything that happens to you is what someone else allows to happen.
Hmm.
So all control is gone. You can't decide where you're going to live. You can't decide really what you're going to do, because there's no money to do anything. And control and self-will almost dissipates. And when you've had that your whole life, when that has been your normal life, you know, you drive your life forwards, and suddenly you can't do that. Where are you? Where are you in your own life? Never mind the wider society.
Mm.
And I think that walk did give us that back, because we chose to follow the map and we chose to live in that tent, but it was our choice.
Mm.
And it was almost, like you said, taking back control. And there's something really empowering about that, to just say, this is my life and I choose how it goes forward.
Yeah. And, you know, like we've said, you didn't know at the start of this walk, this epic walk, how it was going to end, or if it was going to end early, or if you were going to quit or whatever was going to happen, but you ended up seeing these improvements in Moth's health from doing the exact opposite of what you were advised to do. So his mood, he became more mobile, but even sort of more spirited too, felt sort of mentally more equipped to deal with it.
Yeah, because it does have quite a suppressing effect, this illness, on your mental well-being, obviously, as well as your physical well-being. But after we'd walked for quite a few weeks, maybe a couple of hundred miles, I just started to notice his footprints in the dust were just a little more even. That he was more aware of what we were doing, more making choices, making decisions to go forwards that he hadn't been doing before. And then it all sort of culminated in one night on a beach. We arrived at this beach and it was like a perfect late summer day, and the air was really balmy and the sea was like treacle and there were dolphins in the bay and we swam out and it was just a perfect day. Had we not been homeless and he was dying, it would have been perfect. But we put the tent at the, you know, above the high tide mark, so we thought. But then at 3 a.m, we weren't above the high tide mark. So I opened the tent doors and the tide was coming in.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, it was about a metre away from the tent. So we had to jump out of the tent, leaving most of our belongings inside, and pick the whole thing up, still fully erected, and run up the beach. And as we splashed through the water up the beach and dropped the tent down, we just realised what he'd done. but from being told, you know, be careful on the stairs, from the point where he'd been struggling to put his coat on without help, he'd just run up the beach, holding a fully erected tent with half our possessions in, above his head.
Wow.
It felt like a miracle.
Yeah. And this was down to, you know, lots of things that you've discussed in the book, the physical element of it and having that aim every day and that plan, but moving your body in, I guess, it's not a gentle way, because I know that you covered all sorts of terrain, but it's, you know, it's constant motion. Also, you had a very low calorie diet at this point because you didn't have many rations left. But also that connection with nature, that importance of, like you say, almost crossing that line between having the awareness of it, but then feeling part of it. And I think we underestimate how important that connection is. I think actually a lot of the time we totally dismiss it and we just think, oh, whatever. I mean, you certainly don't. But I think en masse, collectively, we kind of go, oh, yeah, it's kind of nice going for a walk. But this has been a huge part of Moth's healing and recovery and stability.
It really has. And I think it's really easy to do, especially when we live in a sort of urban environment, to not put any importance on the connection to the natural world. But there, living as we were wild on those headlands, we were living not alongside nature, but really as part of it. We were there with the seals on the beach and the deer in the woodland and our life was no different in many respects to theirs. And I think there's a huge, powerful shift that happens in your body, actually, when you live in that way for a period of time. It's almost, it's like, how can I describe it? It's like a sort of like strengthening in your body that it's hard to describe. But I noticed it happen in Moth over those weeks. And it's a connection to the natural world. But it'd be really easy for us to be observers of the natural world because that's how we live. We live apart from nature, don't we?
Yeah.
We live separate to it. So to actually admit, even to ourselves, that we are part of it all is something we don't really do, you know?
No, but it's hugely sad that we don't.
Yeah, I just came into your house this morning and just as I was at the door, there was a squirrel jumped from one side of the railing to the other in front of me. And I think we watch these things, don't we? We watch that squirrel jump. But what's the difference? What's the difference between that squirrel jumping across your railings and me walking up your steps?
Yeah.
There's no difference.
I know.
We're the same and we inhabit the same space. So we must, in that way, take something from that. Yeah. I mean, I found research that says that our bodies actually chemically interact with the plant life around us. If that's the case, then we need the natural world on a really physical level. So it's got to be beneficial.
I notice it when I'm swimming in the sea, which I love to do, and I love it for almost inexplicable reasons. It's a visceral experience, and it just feels incredible. And also with my 9-year-old, when he's by the sea, if the sea's really rough, he comes alive. Like, he just stands at the waves with his arms out. And we're watching him like, oh my God, something's going on here. And it is, you know, I think kids also that don't try and overthink or articulate what's going on. So he's just in it. And the waves are like crashing near him and he's feeling it. And we're just so disengaged from it, which I think is probably one of the reasons that we have this sort of mental health crisis going on, but also many new physical illnesses that have cropped up in the last probably 100 years. And it's just that, like you say, like the language is very, we've normalized the notion of, oh, that's nature and we're humans, which is completely abnormal. You know, if you'd gone back thousands of years ago, there would be no distinction. It was just, we are part of it all. And you've had this extreme experience of not only feeling it, but also being with your husband, who obviously has had this illness that you could see visibly and then watch it decrease. That's so powerful.
It's really powerful. I mean, he was moving his body in a way that we're physically made to do.
Yeah.
You know, we're physically made to walk. And so he was just walking, re-imprinting those memories of movement, the muscle memory of movement, With every day, every step, the muscle memory of movement that the tau protein in his brain is wiping out, he's re-imprinting. So in that way, by just doing the thing he's built to do, his brain is finding ways to bypass the bits that are shutting down.
Mm.
They're opening up in other ways.
Yeah.
And that's an incredibly powerful thing. There's a huge, powerful connection there between being our natural selves and our well-being.
Yeah.
Physical, mental well-being. It's all part of the same.
It
the
is.
The same cycle.
It makes me think, I wonder how many different illnesses, whether mental or physical, as you say, you know, it's all the same, that if doctors said, go out and have a walk in nature every day, or go and, you know, sit in a lovely place of nature every day that makes you feel good, rather than stay inside, don't move, rest, I wonder how many more people could be helped by introducing that notion of just the simple stuff, like being out in nature and, like you say, if you can, walking, and like the real basics. I think, again, it's just often sort of overlooked, but it's so, so powerful. It's such an important part of how we are as human beings.
It's just a simple thing. And it's not prescribed, is it?
No.
You know, we know now, we're so aware now of how helpful the natural world can be for mental health.
Yeah.
But it's only just starting to be thought about, even, because it's also really important to our physical health. Starting to meet, as I've been on book tours, talked about a book with so many people, starting to meet people who are occasionally coming to me and saying, I have this illness and I've walked and the symptoms are held at bay. Only 2 days ago, I was talking to someone who had Parkinson's. Similar, slightly connected illness to moths.
Yeah.
And she walks every day. Every single day she walks 5 miles. Every day. And now, 15 years into her Parkinson's.
Wow.
She has a slight tremor. She doesn't take medication. It's not going to fix everybody, but you know, why not get out and go for a walk in the trees?
Absolutely.
Why not? Why
it's
not
never,
try?
Never a bad idea, is it?
It's
I've never regretted going for a walk, ever.
No.
Like after I had sort of collated all my notes for today, yesterday, I was like, I'm just going to take note of Raina here. And I had a massive walk, way longer than I would normally walk, because I'd normally think, oh, I don't want to get overtired when the kids get back from school. I just kept walking. I felt bloody brilliant. Like, there's, you never, ever regret it. I'll go back to talking about health in a minute when we get onto your latest book that I also loved reading, Landlines. But before that, continuing on the salt path note, lots of surprising things are in this book to read about, but also things that you experienced. And one of them being wonderful and awful, and that is how other people react to you when you are out on a very long walk like that. So you've got the kindest of kind coming out when you're meeting people and you don't have food and you don't have shelter and people offering you lifts or food or, well, within this book, a place to stay, which is, I think, again, we underestimate that that is possible when we're out and about. We just sometimes think, oh, I'll be ignored or people are rude, you know, habitually or whatever. But you really experience that kindness. But on the very harsh other end of that, the discrimination towards homelessness is sadly much rifer than I had wanted to believe. I think, you know, we all have an awareness that that discrimination exists, but the amount of abuse that you got, people just talking to you very unkindly or walking away if you mentioned that you were homeless, is sadly very shocking and very prevalent. And I know that homelessness is something that you've put a lot of thought and energy into since writing The Salt Path and the activism around that. And I mean, I want to be hopeful and I want to assume that there are good things happening. I know that obviously during the lockdowns, there were solutions in place and empty hotels became a place of refuge for the homeless. But that's now sadly gone back to the ways prior to the lockdowns. And we're kind of still in a terrible mess with that one. And actually, one of the really surprising things reading your book was my own assumptions that I had made and them being completely wrong. People assuming that a lot of homelessness is due to addiction and that people have got themselves into that mess because of that. And that is such a low percentage of people that are actually on the streets at the moment or classified as homeless. What have you learned since being now, you know, very invested emotionally in this subject matter and wanting to help? You know, can we help? What can we do? What have you learned on that subject?
I think, as you said, the hardest thing to come to terms with when we became homeless was the reaction of other people. To find people actually physically recoil from you when they found you were homeless was shocking. It was shocking. And it took us probably to the lowest place, that place where you question your whole sense of self. And it's a long way back from that. And that point is reached by most people who find themselves rough sleeping on the streets. Those figures that we see for rough sleepers on the streets are so skewed.
Yeah.
They're so wrong. There's snapshots taken at certain moments on certain days when they can't wake anybody who's asleep to check if they're a rough sleeper. Or if the person isn't there, but they know exists, they don't go on the numbers. So those numbers are hugely skewed.
Yeah.
And like you say, those rough sleepers are just a very, very thin end of the wedge. Behind that are hundreds of thousands of people who are homeless, sofa surfing,
yeah,
or just drifting between family and friends, or camping in people's back gardens, or mm-hmm, however they're living. And it's been shocking to find what those numbers are and what the realities of homelessness are. I spent some time with the Street Food Project in Penzance a couple of weeks ago, and they produce hundreds of meals for people within that locality who, for one reason or another, can't eat. But they were telling me that in their local Premier Inn were 80 families who were there because they had no home. 80 families in that small place who weren't allowed to go and eat in the connected restaurant because they were there as homeless people.
Hmm.
And so they were being fed by the Street Food Project. And that's the attitude that we take.
Hmm.
And I think, yes, we solved it all during lockdown. We solved it because it was everyone in. But then afterwards, it was everyone back out again.
Yeah.
And there were areas where, such as Bristol, where the street homeless numbers tripled from one side of lockdown to the other. And this winter coming, as things are, it's only going to get worse.
And then we've got the cost of living crisis going
exactly
on, so people can't even afford to put the heating on. It's like, it's just, what a terrifying mess.
It's only going to get worse. But if it's not being addressed from the top down, which it isn't,
no,
then the only way to deal with it is from the bottom up,
yeah,
as far as I can see. And the only way we can deal with it is to say, these are our homeless within our community, within our area. These are the people who need the help. If it's not coming from the top down, then it has to come from us.
Yeah.
And I can't see any other way of approaching it.
So it's community-based. It's knowing what's going on in your own area, if there are initiatives that are set up to help, soup kitchens, food banks, etc., and just trying to support on your own. Because when you look at it, even in a national sense, it's terrifying. You think, oh God, I can't infiltrate that in a positive way. How would I help at all? But if we can look on a community level, that's... Because like you say, it's not... It's probably never going to come from the top.
No, it isn't. It isn't. But it's a problem that we have, that we hold as part of our society.
Mm.
And do we ignore that? Or do we say each of those people that have come to that position have come through their own story, their own route? They're all individuals. They're not problematic statistics. They're individuals that need our help.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can all chop some carrots for the Street Food Project.
Yeah.
Or whatever it takes.
But I think, you know, knowing that even the numbers that seem shocking, either in your books or ones you can Google, are way, way lower than the numbers in reality, it's definitely motivating, to say the least, for us all to try and do a little bit where we can and help where we can, because it's just an unbelievable problem. So I really want to get onto this latest book, which I've already hinted to you earlier before we started, that I loved, and I wept at the end. It's so beautiful. So this was a whole other adventure. So you had noticed that Moth's health again had started to decline and that his levels of comfort weren't so great. So you tentatively had this other guidebook, this trail book floating around, and you kept leaving it in certain areas of the house for Moth to perhaps sort of see and get a hint. And you went on this extraordinary adventure that starts in Scotland. But I know the start of that walk for you emotionally was very mixed, because you felt a lot of guilt, and a lot of guilt that Moth might not really want to be there, and also if it was the right thing to do. How did you push past that guilt to then have this extraordinary adventure?
Exactly. It was so difficult. It was the winter of 2021, and we were in that final lockdown, and just like everyone else, we were trapped in our locality. Moth wasn't walking as much as he needed to, doing all the other physical things that he always does, but alongside that he normally takes quite a lot of long walks, and we weren't really doing that, and his health began to decline really quickly, and to the point where he was almost accepting that this was it, those final stages were coming. But I couldn't face that, and like you said, found this little guidebook to the Cape Wrath Trail, the most remote, the most isolated trail in the country, in you know, the highlands of Scotland that goes through the great wilderness and the rough bounds of Knoydart, areas that don't have roads, that you can only reach on foot and by boat. But I knew he would love to go there. It was a place he'd always wanted to go, but never had time to spend. And so I just left that guidebook around the house. And it came to the point where he brought it into the kitchen, he slapped it down on the worktop and said, going north then.
What a great announcement.
But then we got there and the reality of it struck, and we were in this incredible wild landscape, wilder than anywhere else in Britain. It was dark and foreboding, but also incredibly just you and the natural world. There was nothing else. And the guilt started to really build up at that point, that I'd brought him, I'd encouraged him to this wilderness, wild, exposed, desolate place, when really all the instincts that you have when you're with someone who's ill is to wrap them in cotton wool and keep them on the sofa. But I'd dragged him to this place, and he was unsure whether he even had the strength to do it. And so the guilt was massive, and it grew.
But then you had this really amazing moment where you were able to like push the guilt to one side, because you'd noticed again, out of the blue, these physical improvements, and you were almost sort of blinded by the guilt. So you hadn't seen the incremental improvements. And then you were like, oh, actually, it's working again. And he was getting his strength back. And then without either of you really saying it, you realised you wanted to keep on walking. Once you'd reached Fort William, which is where you'd sort of planned to end the walk, neither of you were quite ready.
Yeah, it was a bit of a struggle, but we made it down to Fort William. And Moth, you know, his health was improving. His walking was more fluid. His fine motor movements were better. He was putting the top back on the water bottle without such an issue. He was tying his boots up without help. But he really felt his health hadn't improved as rapidly as it had when we were on the coast path. But then he was coming from a worse point than we had then. But then he said, let's go on. He chose to go on. We were sitting on a bench in Fort William, and we thought there were three other people on the bench, but two of them got up and left, and the third one was a statue. And it was a statue of a man with his leg crossed, rubbing his foot, and it was the end marker of the West Highland Way. And Moth was saying, okay, another 10 days, maybe a week, you know, 100 miles, maybe just another 100 miles further, and that will do it. So the guilt began to dissipate then, because it was his choice to go on. And then we went on and on.
And on.
And on.
And then you had this incredible moment yet again where you thought you'd kind of come to an end point where, yeah, you know, we've done that extra surprising leg of this extraordinary walk. And then you decided to keep walking all the way home to Cornwall.
Well, yes. I mean, we'd walked the Pennine Way, and that was another 268 miles. across those incredible blanket bogs, and we'd reached sort of Manchester, and suddenly half the country was behind us.
Wow.
And it felt like the obvious thing to do.
To you.
Just keep going.
It's just mad, from Scotland to Cornwall. It's so brilliant. It's so, I mean, just reading these adventures, there's so many magical and inexplicable moments along the way. And you talk about this trail magic, these moments where things just happen, and, you know, the stories of all the different people that you've met. What can you put trail magic down to? What is that? Is it mindset?
Trail magic. It's such a wonderful idea. The idea that, you know, when you're on a long distance trail, that what you need or what you want will come to you, you know, just magically. It will come to you. Or at least you'll feel some sort of like awe and wonder. Yeah, we met a group of people on this really remote campsite that you could only get to by foot or boat. And it was on the most beautiful bay I've ever been to. And they were talking about trail magic, the idea that, you know, that things will come. And we were almost out of food. And the following morning, it was sort of 4 o'clock, it was, the light was just starting to break. And this hand came beneath the fly sheet of the tent. And I was like, what is happening? This is awful. And this hand put a Mars bar and some Haribos into the pan that was under the fly sheet. And I was about to say something, but I saw this outline of a person put their finger to their mouth and go, shh, it's trail magic. And it was wonderful. But that's what it feels like. It's the idea that on those long distance paths, that they induce some sort of like honesty that we don't have in normal life, because in normal lives we're so guarded and careful.
Mm.
But when you've been walking for a long way, then people, and it seems to happen that everyone you encounter that has walked a long distance can have that same sort of sense of openness and willingness to share, not just the Haribos, but to share themselves.
Why do you think that is? Is it because you know that you've just met another bunch of people that are perhaps also just thinking more about survival than happiness or everyday shenanigans, that, you know, our minds are full of nonsense a lot of the time in everyday life?
I think you've said it there. It's about the happiness, actually. Mm. Because I think when you've walked all those miles, somehow you've sort of shed those layers of anxiety, those layers of madness, those layers of concern about everyday sort of things. And what you're left with is something a little more raw,
yeah,
something a little more real. And that's what you're encountering. You're encountering the depth of someone.
Yeah, there's no suit of armor.
The surface.
Yeah, because we're all sort of turning up with, like, we want the person that we're with to see the best version of us, the energetic version of us, and the put together version of us. And actually, in that circumstance, you know, I can think about even the little walks that I've done, probably on day 4, and you've done a wee in front of your mate or whatever, and you think, actually, I'm not putting on any front. I am just going to be straight up me. And that might mean silence, or it might mean talking about something that feels really important in that moment, but you just drop all the layers of stuff and the roles that you carry around with you. And that's on a tiny walk that I've done, but I can't even imagine the levels of, I guess, freedom you would feel in that sense of losing all of those expectations of yourselves and dynamics that you feel you have to involve yourself in. There is perhaps a freedom in that.
There is a huge freedom, because we carry so much that we don't even realise.
Yeah.
We think we are just being ourselves and being this wonderful, upfront, loud, vivacious person.
Mm.
Whereas actually, we don't notice ourselves building that layer upon layer upon layer of shell.
Yeah.
That creates that. It's like today. I arrived here after 3 hours on the motorway, after not going to bed till 4 o'clock this morning.
Oh, God, Raina.
And last night, having done the washing for the first time in 2 weeks, and then realising this morning that I was going to come and meet Fern Cotton and I had no dry clothes. So I came here in the most random outfit, having not washed my hair since the gig last night. It was very hot.
Your hair looks amazing, by the way.
And knowing that my face has had a massive breakout because I've eaten cheese and I'm allergic to it.
It gets better.
But that's what you encounter on a long distance trail, is that person in the raw, that real person that's underneath the
So you met the real you.
Yes, and that's the thing. You don't know the real you because we never give ourselves the opportunity to find it.
I don't know if I've met the real me. Like maybe in tiny snapshots, like giving birth, or like those moments where you do just have to get rid of all, like everything.
All the pretension goes out of the door.
Yeah, like in labour, certainly, when I'm sort of like was roaring like a lion, I was probably, I didn't care what anyone thought or... And it's those moments are few and far between. Mm. Whereas for you on these long walks, that's an incremental shedding where you go, oh, and did you have a moment where you were like, oh, this is me. This is nice.
I think there was a moment on the south coast of the coast path when we were just leaving Falmouth and it was very, very crowded. It was summer. There were lots of people eating scones and jam and there were wasps everywhere and beer and people everywhere. And we took this tiny ferry over to a place called Place. And suddenly we'd left all those people on the other side of the water and there was no one on the other side. And we carried on walking and we went into this part of the coast path where there was loads of undergrowth and it was almost like you were walking through tunnels of blackthorn and gorse and brambles and I almost felt like almost like a rabbit disappearing into the undergrowth, and that sense of here I am, this is me, here I am, not that person I think I am, but here is the real person.
Yeah.
And I think ever since that moment, I think I've held on to that knowledge that however many layers we have to put on for life, sometimes you have to take them off again and find what's underneath.
Yeah, it's difficult because now, you know, you're sort of integrated back into the chaos of everything. You know, your book tours or the shows that you've been the musical shows you've been putting on or... doing press for your books like this, it's much harder to feel that sense of I know who I am and it is this, you know, being that's connected to the nature that likes peace. And, you know, I know myself as much as I can. As I've got older, it's certainly got easier to detect, oh, no, this feels right. And I like small, quiet, peaceful, less people around. You know, I really love being on my own and I love just finding those moments of peace. I think that's the closest I can get to going, oh yeah, I can feel who I am. Whereas if I'm around a lot of people, noise, that's when my head starts going, what do these people want me to be like? And you know, you just start to spiral. So I can imagine it's a lot harder now you're not on a path every day waking up in a tent with that beautiful nature and all around you. Maybe takes more effort to lose those layers.
I think I have to do it consciously now.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, when you're on a trail, it just happens without you noticing. I've been, as you said, on tour with a folk band and we've produced this wonderful thing. I'm not really
sure
what it is, but it's this like production. It's a combination of words and music, and it's become a portrait of the southwest, of the people, the traditions, the place. And we had our final night last night in Milton Keynes, and it was sold out and it was full of people, massively enthusiastic. But there's this thing when I'm on stage, because I'm a really not gregarious person. I'm not a person who's happy in crowds at all, but there I am on a stage delivering all these words. For that, obviously, I've got to put on that other person. But when it finished, I had to go outside. It was pouring with rain and just look up at the sky and say, okay, I can breathe now.
Yeah.
Here I am. And I have to take those moments because I think now I know I need to keep going back to that place because mentally, physically, that's where my well-being resides.
Yeah.
Is in that.
I think it does for most of us and we ignore it and we push through. No, come on, you've got to do more, experience more, push myself. And actually, I mean, you can still, you know, you've proved very much you can push yourself, but in the most natural way of using your own body to walk and experience the extremities of the natural world. But we don't have to push ourselves through stress and people and noise and chaos. We do need to counterbalance it and have that time out and that respite. And we don't. We, you know, I think our whole culture is sort of built on that. No, keep going, like push, push, push. And it's, you know, it's not good for any of us. And I think the other thing that became very obvious to me from reading your books is, you know, not only, if we go back to that sort of trail magic, not only do you have to get into quite a hopeful mindset at times for survival, but actually you leave room, you leave space, which again, we don't do in the modern world. We cram every minute of the day with things we should be doing and obligations or whatever it might be. But you leave this room on a walk like that where magic or the unexpected does come in, and some extraordinary things can happen if you give the space for that. There has to be the room for it. I don't think magic or the unexpected can fit into a very, very busy schedule. There's just not space. But you had all these extraordinary things happen, like in your first book, the yoga guy that you bump into, who basically sort of tells you your future, which then comes into fruition. He says something really random like you'll walk with a tortoise, and then you end up down the way seeing a guy walking a tortoise. I mean, you have to leave room for those little moments to occur.
Oh, you do. You do. You have to be open to them and open to the possibility of them, I think. And I think we're often so close that we don't even notice those weird moments in life when they're happening. I mean, who ever is going to tell you you're going to walk with a tortoise? I mean, it's crazy. But then to find that actually there is someone walking a tortoise on a dog lead and he calls it lettuce and takes it out for a walk every day. You really, those moments, you just don't, you don't witness them. But when you've got your head down and you're going from A to B, you just don't witness them.
I felt excited reading those moments because there's loads of moments like that in your book where you end up staying in a random barn for the night and you meet a whole bunch of brilliant characters, and it really made me excited, like, oh no, I need to just leave more room and those moments will happen without effort, without forcing them, without desperately wanting them to happen. You've just got to leave the space.
Yes, you can't find those things.
No.
You can't go out and look for them and say, today I'm going to have an experience.
No.
You've got to be open to allow it to happen. You've got to leave, as you say, a space, an emptiness.
But we're such control freaks, aren't we, that we don't. And I think that's, again, what you and Moth have demonstrated so perfectly in these books is that, okay, you gain some control in saying we're making this decision, we're going to walk, but actually on a daily basis, you have to sort of let go. And I think we all find that very difficult to, you've then got to have hope and faith that you're going to be okay. You know, you've got kids, you want to, at the end of this walk, be able to go and see your children and say, we did it, here we are, we're fit, we're fighting, we're healthy. So you have to have that hope and faith. And I think rather than, I'm talking collectively here, rather than all of us leaning into hope, we get very controlling. And it must be like this so that everything is going to be okay. And actually, that really doesn't serve us as well.
I think we all think we can plan our way out of every situation. That by making a schedule, then everything will work out and it'll all be okay.
I hate it.
We all do. We all do. And the busier we get, the more we do it.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think if you just allow yourself that space, then things can take their own route. They can take their own course. We allowed ourselves to walk down the country, whereas actually my schedule said I should have gone back.
Yeah.
But we allowed ourselves to do it. And that's the thing. We tell ourselves we can't do things. We tell ourselves it's not possible because I have to A, B, C, D.
Mm.
But do you?
No, do usually. You? No. I think most of us could go, do I have to? Probably not. Probably not.
And sometimes, Glenn, when you say, I don't actually have to, that's where...
That's the space.
The hope, the space, the trail magic falls in.
It's so important. It's so important. This is a huge spoiler alert for anyone that wants to read Landlines and not know the end. But there is the most moving moment, which I said I wept at.
I haven't given away that very, very ending.
Let's just say everything that we've talked about today and everything that you've talked about in your books, the power and the connection of nature, hope, giving yourself space, physically moving your body every day in the way that it's supposed to. Human connection, experiencing kindness from other humans. What we can say is all of that is everything. Like, it's so important. It's not all the other stuff. It's not being popular. It's not having the supposedly perfect job, the supposedly perfect new trendy pair of shoes. It's not all that crap. What we've talked about today is so much more powerful than any of us could ever believe.
That's it. Summed it up.
Without giving too much away.
Yeah.
That sums it up. And it is, that's why everybody needs to read all of your books. And then they need to go and find their own path and their own trail and their own trail magic and create the space.
I think that's it. You can't choose someone else's life.
No.
You can't follow a profile on social media and say, that's the life I want to live. Because there's only your life will fit you.
Yeah.
And you need to choose that for yourself, for what genuinely comes from within you, not for the influences you take from outside. And then life changes in the most remarkable ways, because then you fit your life.
Yeah.
You don't fit someone else's life.
And then you don't fall short, because I think when you're trying to be someone else or replicate someone else's path, success, whatever it is, you feel, and I've definitely done that when I was younger, sort of emulate other people. And then you feel like, well, I'm not hitting the mark. It's not, I don't feel anything, or I feel like I'm failing or whatever.
I'm not as good as that.
I'm not as good. Yeah, the comparison. Yeah. But when, you know, everything that you've done since that, you know, diagnosis of your husband and losing your house, everything you've done has been from within. It's been a turn inwards, a look at what you really feel, your intuition, those guidebooks pulling you without you being able to even make sense of your next step, your next decision. It's all been that gut feeling that I think all of us want to experience and trust. Because I think you do have to trust it. You can feel it, but you've got to then trust it to do the action bit as well.
You absolutely have to. Maybe it was easier for me because all those other things of life have been taken away. So it allowed me to trust those instincts, to feel those emotions anew. But sometimes even within life now, I have to do that. You've got to trust what you feel, that it actually emanates from you and not from some other outside influence.
Yeah.
Because that's the real feeling that will take you forward.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of courage, because I think we all get swayed by what everybody else is saying, what everyone's thinking. And sometimes you might want to do something that's completely opposite to everyone around you. It could seem like completely out of the blue and the unconventional option. But if it feels right to you, that is the right path.
Absolutely, it is. When we were walking down the Pennine Way, it was this incredible storm on the moors, fork lightning falling all around us, and the path turned into mud, and we were heading down through this forest, and coming up towards us there was this old man, and his pack, his rucksack and his clothes were just pouring in water. And he got this huge beard and it was full of twigs and sticks, and we said, where are you going? He said, I'm walking the Pennine Way. He said, well, in this storm, what are you doing? He said, no, it doesn't matter. Tomorrow the sun will shine. Tonight I'm just going to go and sleep under the trees, and the trees will protect me and it'll be fine. I just do 5 miles a day. That's all I can do. I'll sleep here. Tomorrow I'll go on.
Mm.
A few days later, we met another old man dressed in lycra, looking very, very sad. We said, you know, what's the matter? What's the problem? And he said, I'll never walk another long distance path, this or any other, again in my life. And I've walked this 6 times already, the Pennine Way. I said, well, why? You know, expecting him to tell us that he was ill. And he said, because I've always done the Pennine Way in 10 days and now it's going to take me 15. This was a man in his 70s, and he was telling us that this thing that he'd had this passion for, walking these paths, he was never going to do again because he didn't meet his own criteria for what made it acceptable. And yet there was that other old man just plodding along.
Yeah.
And I know that he will keep walking until he can't take another step, and he'll take immense pleasure just from the beauty of the landscape,
yeah,
from the lightning, from the rain, from sleeping on the pine needles. Mm. And I think that's the thing. Step away from the pressure and smell the pine needles.
Oh, I like that. That's got to go on a T-shirt.
I love that so much.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And I think, you know, on a similar note, my massive takeaway from reading your books has been that we often think happiness is going to come from absolute comfort, extreme comfort in every way, down every possible avenue of comfort. And actually what your books have proved is that it's completely the opposite. If you put yourself in very testing situations where your focus is not on comfort, it's on survival, subsequently you will just have moments of happiness that will just creep in without you controlling them or desperately wanting them. They'll just appear.
Absolutely. I've felt some of my greatest happiness in the most extremely difficult for me situations. Walking on the coast path with no money, no food, nowhere to live. Some of the happiest moments of my life because there was nothing else. Mm. Because all that mattered was the next step and the next bag of noodles. On this tour with the band, with this weird Salt Lines project that we've created, completely, absolutely out of my comfort zone, performing on a stage, and yet with this wonderful, incredible group of the most almost miraculous musicians that I would never have met had I not been homeless on the coast path. Mm. Yeah, some of the best things in life come from the worst moments.
Yeah.
And I think somewhere in there is where real happiness lies.
I completely agree with you. And can't thank you enough for, first of all, writing these brilliant books, but being here today and talking to me. I am going to go on a walk straight after this, get in the park and smell the pine needles.
Fantastic.
Do you know what? It's just so true that the great outdoors creates an honesty about who you are. I love that concept. Raina, thank you so much for sharing all those stories with us. I just loved them. You can go on more travels with Raina in her latest book, Landlines. It's a completely beautiful read. And I would definitely urge you to look into what you can do on a community level to help those who are homeless. I'd also love for you to share your experiences of transformative experiences in nature on Instagram. Tell us what's helped you. Maybe some really special places you visited. We're at Happy Place Official on Instagram. Until next time, thank you again to Raina, to the producer Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you. You are the best.